Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 817. I still sort of have a voice partway through Comic-Con, which is very exciting. Probably be gone by tomorrow, though. I would like to go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. Nerdist Community Corkboard. Our Nerdist activity is happening possibly by you in the Nerdist community, or someone near you, or someone near that person. I'm very excited that Leonard Maltin has joined the Nerdist Network. Maltin on Movies is his new podcast. It's hosted by, of course, Leonard Maltin, who you know. If you are of my generation, you adore Leonard Maltin. If you are one of the millennial generations, you probably know Leonard Maltin because of Doug Benson. So he's a film critic, a great guy, and he talks about new movies, his favorite movies, he interviews actors, writers, and more. Episodes are every Friday, so thanks to Leonard Maltin for joining the Nerdist Podcast Network. This episode is Butch Vig. Butch is a legendary producer, music producer, and he's also in the band Garbage, which I was so on the Garbage train. I worked at K-Rock when Garbage came out, and I pulled Garbage and played Garbage every chance I could. And then Shirley Mantz was on the podcast last year, and fell more in love with her. So Butch, it was fantastic and had some really great stories. And he is promoting their latest album, Strange Little Birds. So please pick that up and support talented, nice people. This is Butch Vig here on the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 817. Katie, roll the thing. I can only get that low when my voice is chewed up from shouting at Comic-Con panels and parties.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Someone from Disney was like, here, Chris.
No, but if anyone from Disney wants to send me original cells from classic Disney films, I'll take them.
All right, you're on the record. Great.
Do you collect anything?
Not really. No, not really.
Do you not like clutter?
You know, I sort of do. I'm kind of a pack rat. My wife, though, just kind of freaks out when stuff is around, so she's always like putting stuff in closets and you know, moving them out of the way. I have a lot of music sort of memorabilia, but photos and things like that. And Packers. I'm a big Packers fan.
Oh, okay. You know, gotcha.
So I listened to the Aaron Rodgers podcast. He's the man.
Oh, yeah. He did Pete's show, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was – that was – Aaron's such a nice guy.
Yeah.
I'm not a sports guy. And
he's not at all.
And the first time I met him, I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm not a sports guy. And he was like, no, that's fine. Like, because I wasn't gonna like pin him down and be like, hey, how come in the game against – who do they play against, man?
Well, the Lions game, it was a very, you know, great drive last year, you know, in the last seconds. Like, I thought the game was over, and then he goes and just drops bombs on him.
Yeah, he had two Hail Marys last year. Most quarterbacks don't get one of those ever in the history of their career.
And he got two in the same game.
No,
not in the same game.
One was in the playoffs against the Cardinals, but everyone forgets that because the Cardinals won that game, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, Cardinals won. Like, the next play, they threw a, like, 60-yard pass or something.
So they didn't give him due credit.
They were like, here's another bomb. But, like, when you're watching Aaron Rodgers throw that ball, you're like, oh, he's going to do it. He's going to do it. I'm a Patriots fan, so I get it. I get what it's like to have a quarterback.
Patriots fan, yeah.
Now I feel like you guys need to have like some really intense debate about your teams with insight.
Well, I have no ill feelings towards the Green Bay Packers. It's not like they're like
Giants.
What
kind of a sports fan
are
you?
Jets.
If you can't,
well, we rarely see each other, you know, except in the Super Bowl in '96, where Brett Favre should have won and won, so it was fine.
That's
was
true. Like, yeah,
I get it.
Parcells was the coach.
Bill,
there, right?
Yeah,
Bill Parcells.
Big fish.
What is it that you like about the Pack? Well, I know you're from Wisconsin.
It's in my DNA. You know, I had no choice. You know, when you're in the town I grew up in, a very small town, western Wisconsin, Viroqua, on Sundays, you could rob any building you want. You know, it's like everybody is glued at kickoff at noon, and everyone's glued in front of the TV watching the Pack play.
So you know that. I'm sure you've been to Mars Cheese Castle.
Oh yeah,
enough times.
Yeah.
Oh, hang on.
What? There's what's Oscar Mars Mayer. Cheese there's the Wiener Mobile. You know, that's a famous Wisconsin.
Wait, Matt just said what's Mars
I don't
Cheese
know
Castle?
What the cheese castle is
Mars Cheese.
Explain this to me because I love castles and cheese.
It's a big. It's in between. I feel like I was out. Is it outside of Kenosha?
Well, if you go on the strip between like Milwaukee and Chicago, it's just a strip. There's all these like burger joints.
Yeah.
But my favorite personally is White Castle.
Oh, you like White Castle?
White Castle.
You like White Castle.
That's my jam, yeah.
Yeah?
Mars Cheese Castle is basically
like a tiny burger full
of onions. It's just a big cheese place. It's just like there's a lot of cheese. They have a lot of cheese.
Well, I look forward to visiting it someday.
Yeah.
You will go there sometime.
I look forward to it.
I really like Wisconsin. It's one of those places where when I'll visit when the weather is kind. And I'll go, I totally understand why people would live here. And then but then a lot of the time.
You also visit in like February.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And then I realize like, oh yeah, I would never survive.
It's cold, man. Yeah, kind is mid-April to around Halloween or so. And then it starts to get nasty cold.
Yeah. Do you ever envision yourself moving back to Wisconsin?
You know, possibly. I love going back there. My dad still lives in the house I grew up in. He's 93. Oh, lives by himself. In Viroqua, and my brother and sister, and I have a ton of friends who all live in Madison. I kind of call it my hometown in a way because I spent many years there.
Yeah.
And we go back usually once in the summer, my wife and my daughter and I, and it's sometimes in the winter, but not always in the winter.
Madison and Milwaukee are fun towns to perform in. Like, those are good, and I think because people, it's a culture of understanding how to be indoors in a responsible way because for most of the year you have to be indoors. So I feel like people really, they go to shows, they pay attention, they get involved. Like it feels like a good, you must have performed in Madison.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I know every gin joint, cafe, bar, club, tavern, roadhouse through the state. You know, I played in bands in high school and college, and this is before garbage, but I played them all, you know, but cut my teeth in some pretty funky places there.
Was it? Did you enjoy kind of going behind the scenes to produce, or did the whole time you were producing, you're like, I really want to be playing more. This is like you're basically making stuff for other people. Is that how do you separate yourself emotionally and go, okay, I can make this for them, but I still have a piece of creative stuff for me.
You know, I was always in bands before I became a producer, and even when I got successful, I still liked that sort of camaraderie, the clicky thing of hanging with your bandmates. Yeah. It's a thing. And I've been working with Duke from Garbage. We were in bands in college and for 30 plus years. And I like it. I like that that band mentality, us against the world. You know, I'm very close with my bandmates in Garbage. I think that's one of the reasons that we're still together after 20 years. You gotta like hanging with the people you're making music with.
That's so crazy that you guys have been together 20 years. That's so weird. Because I worked at K-Rock when you guys formed. And I remember, I think Queer was the first track off that album, right? And then Stupid Girl was the one that blew everything wide open. I think people really liked Queer. And then Stupid Girl, I remember just being in heavy rotation at K-Rock. If you played a song twice on your shift, that means that Weatherly was way into it.
No, right on. Cool. Yeah, K-Rock, one of the first stations that played any tracks by Garbage. We weren't even done with the record. And our manager now, Paul Kremen, was working for Elmo, which was going through Geffen Universal. And we got this excited call, K-Rock's playing Garbage, you got to finish the damn record. We were just sitting around in Wisconsin drinking beer going, yeah, we should finish this mix, get this track done. Because we had no plans, you know, we weren't going to tour. I was going to just go back to producing.
So it was just a passion project.
Kind of. And when we started, it was just, we were doing it for fun, really.
Was it like you're traveling Wilburys? You're like, yeah, here, we'll just do this and then put
it out. Sort of, yeah. You know, Shirley was the least likely inclined to tour because she didn't really know Duke and Steve and me.
Yeah,
she was like, well, I don't want to get on stage with you guys. That would just be weird. Now she is the ultimate road dog.
Yes.
She's the road dog in the band.
She was on last year. She was on our show. She's fantastic.
She's the MVP of Garbage. I mean, she's a great singer and a great front person. She's really charismatic, and she's a road dog.
Now, it already seems like in just the couple minutes that I've been talking to you, I get the sense you're just a nice, laid-back Wisconsin guy. And is that a necessary temperament to have,
when you are working with bands where there might be, I'm going to say, some strong personality types and strong opinions?
Well, a lot of artists can be somewhat dysfunctional from time to time. And I think that's part of what makes them creative in a way. They don't necessarily know how to deal with the real world sometimes. At least that's how I work. I try to stay pretty chill and not get too, I don't even know what the right term is. Don't get too aggressive with bands. I like them to let their guard down and sort of forget that I'm there almost. It seems to work. You know, every now and then I'll throw a chair or smash a phone. Or I've done it not very many times when I really get pushed over the edge. And then people are scared, I think, when they see me go psycho. It's only happened about it maybe a half dozen times in 3 years. But sometimes you got to go psycho.
What kind of a situation makes you go psycho? Is it if something isn't being played right, or if someone's just being a dick?
More if they're just being a dick. You know, if they're having a hard time playing something, you just got to work it out. You just keep either take a break and come back to it, or suggest a different way to play or perform. Usually it's when someone's being a dick that sometimes you got to put your foot down.
Absolutely. How much of the albums you produce do you feel like, or do you feel like these are my albums, or that's that band's album and I just kind of helped it along?
You know, I really have to remember when I'm producing someone, it's their album and it's their vision, and it's my job to help them get to their vision. You know, in Garbage, it's my band and I get to write songs with my bandmates, and it's a whole different kind of mind space in a way. But when I'm producing, I have to constantly be aware. I have to do the best thing for the band, make smart decisions.
And how do you get people to open up who might not, as you said, necessarily have a realistic outlook of the real world? And like, how do you, is every person a little bit different? Do you have to spend time with them to kind of crack them open, or is it just we just start working together and then you figure it out?
Usually that comes after spending some time together, so they chill a little bit. Yeah. You know, and usually I will do that. There's a process where I'll try to hang with them, you know, listening to songs before we go in the studio, going out to dinner, starting to communicate about books, movies, like just so you get to understand someone better. And then it's weird. You go into a room and it's close quarters, and it can get really intense, you know. So the best thing, at least for me, is to get the artist to just sort of forget I'm there, you know, whatever that takes to keep them relaxed.
It kind of seems like that era that Nevermind sort of ushered in, that era of, you know, it was around the same time. I remember I bought Pearl Jam's 10, and I didn't know what it was because it was so close to the 80s at that point. And they, you know, like I didn't know what all the flannel was. You know, this is a relatively pre-internet era for everyone. So I was like, what is this? Is this like a weird, I just didn't, and then I heard it, and I was like, well, this doesn't sound like anything I've ever heard before. And then of course, Nirvana comes around, and then it's a complete new era. And also the beginning of the end of the old music business days. Were you sensing that at the time?
You know, when you're in the middle of it, it's hard to know where things are going. I was producing all these punk rock bands in Madison at my studio, Smart Studios, and that led to working with bands like Smashing Pumpkins and Nirvana. And honestly, we felt like we were sort of underground still. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, Nevermind just kind of took off, went insanely crazy. And no one really saw that coming, but looking back now, I think it's one of those records that really the timing was kind of perfect, because coming out of the 80s, there was a lot of really kind of slick music on the radio, like Madonna and CNC Music Factory. I think Michael Jackson was number one, and Nirvana kicked him out of the number one slot at the time. So there's something about that record, about Nevermind, that really spoke to people. It felt real, I think, and quite visceral. And it spoke to a whole generation of kids who I think were not getting that of what they were hearing on Top 40 music at the time.
And do you feel like all that stuff was real, or do you feel like, no, we just swapped big hair and leather stretch pants for flannel and chain wallets?
Well, some people would argue your point there, Chris. music always goes in cycles, and something will get popular, and then the labels always jump on everything they can find, mm-hmm. whether it's hair metal bands, and they got kicked out, and then alternative music or grunge or whatever you want to call it became very popular, and then that started to slip away a little bit, and hip-hop had a big boom in the 90s, and right now you see EDM, electronica,
yeah.
you know, dance music is massive, and that'll become passé at some point. Everything just, you know, changes. People's tastes change.
Yeah.
I mean, it is pretty remarkable, though, that, it, you know, when you say, oh, you know, garbage started 20 years ago, but even going back further, it's still weird to me that, like, 1991, 92 was 25. Like, that's a difficult number for me to wrap my head around. That
just
now,
a quarter century, Chris.
Now, I think I, you know, like,
it is.
You hear some of those, you know, you hear some of the early 90s stuff, like, on oldie stations. You're like, it's not old. Oh, fuck yeah. Like, when I, in the 80s, you know, like, you'd hear 60s on the station. That's the same, it's the same delineation of time. I mean, does it feel like so far long ago, or does it feel like, oh my God, that just happened. What? That was 25 years ago?
Yeah, both, really. I guess because I'm still just really involved in music, and some of the people who I've made music, Garbage and also Dave Grohl, I've worked with very closely. You know, I made Nevermind with them almost 25 years ago, and I'm really good friends with them. And so the music, in a way, it's less about the music and more about just relationships, you know, I have with people.
I mean, does it feel like when you were younger, did you always say, like, yeah, man, once I hit 40, I'm going to quit this shit. You know, when you're like 20, 22 years old, like, when I hit 40, it's all, and you get to 40 and you're like, hey, okay, there's not that, come on, it's not that crazy. It's not that old. I mean, did you ever think that when you were younger? Or did you think you'd be doing this forever?
I guess I never really thought about it either way, but I don't have any hobbies. When you asked me when I came in, do you collect anything? I went, no, I'm sad to say I don't really collect anything. No, not really. I have a few guitars at home, and I have a couple nice drum kits. I have some nice microphones, but
there you go.
Really, maybe about 20.
You know? But you 20 use microphones.
I have like 25 microphones.
But you can use those for your work, so I don't know if that really counts.
I do use them for work.
So that's not a hobby then. Like, a hobby is just the thing that, you know.
Yeah,
like,
but he's really into microphones. See, he's a dork.
What's your favorite microphone?
Well, it depends on what you're recording.
I want to mic a drum kit. Let's say I want to mic a floor tom. What do you want? What am I going to use?
You know, a good utility mic for pretty much everything is the Shure SM7.
Yeah.
SM7, not the 57. The SM7's got the wider barrel on it.
Uh-huh.
You know, you see them a lot of times in radio stations, whatever. You can put on a kick drum, on a guitar. You can do vocals with it. They work pretty damn well.
That's your Swiss Army
knife.
You can
kick it and drop it on the floor, and it's going to work. You know, it's pretty solid.
Nice. It's a tank. It's a tank
of
microphones.
A tank, but it sounds good.
How far into the process do you get? I mean, like, do you know? So when you're producing Nevermind, and you sit down with the band, and they go, "Well, this is what we want to do," and you go, "Okay, I want to help you try to realize that." Does the vision carry through pretty much all the way through, or how flexible do you have to be throughout the process to go, I know we started here, but maybe we should do this instead?
You know, that happens on every record I do. I get in my head an idea of where it's going to go and what it's going to sound like, and that always changes. And kind of changes almost every day I walk into a studio. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I'm still doing it. You know, rather than retire at 40, I still like to go into the studio every day, because you never know what's going to happen, really.
Yeah. Did you ever want to be a front? Did you ever want to be a frontman?
No, sir. I've always liked being on the drum kit. You know,
why is
kind
that?
Kind of in the background, kind of keeping it together, helping glue it together a little bit.
There was not. Where is the Phil Collins story in the life of Butch Vig?
I can't sing very well, for one thing.
All right, where's your Ringo story?
Yeah, well, God bless Ringo, man. You know, I was just reading about that the other day. He had some quote. You know, they always gave him one song to sing on every record.
Right.
I think that's really cool that they did that.
Yeah.
Well, we've got to get a song for Ringo on this album. What should we write today? How about, Yellow Submarine?
Yeah. Sounds good. then they all agree, and then John insults him a lot, and
I don't think it was like that.
You don't think so?
No. I think they loved Ringo.
They
really
loved
do.
Him. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but didn't John say he's not even the best?
No, that's an inaccurate quote.
Oh,
that's a fake quote. That's not a real quote.
Apocrypha.
Ringo, you know, Ringo is a badass drummer. He was
he's
not
great.
As flamboyant as someone like Keith Moon or John Bonham, but he's just an amazing drummer.
If you really want to get an idea of how good Ringo is, I highly recommend, if it's not copyright blocked on YouTube now, if you can go back and listen to, like, Please Please Me recorded with Pete Best, and then you can listen to it recorded with Ringo, and that's when the light goes off and you're like, oh, Ringo's so much better. And Ringo always would, the backbeat thing, like, he would wait to the last possible
millisecond,
the
and then it came in, yeah.
And he was so, Ringo's so good.
What makes a good drummer?
Well, there's so many different styles of drumming. I mean, for me personally, because I'm kind of a song guy, it's always, the drums need to work in the context of all the other musicians. You know, fills can be a hook. Mm. The groove has to be solid. I know if you're a jazz drummer, that's a whole different thing, or a funk drummer, that's different, but there's so many good drummers out there. Dave Grohl's a pretty good drummer.
He's a pretty good drummer.
Pretty good drummer. You know, and he doesn't even play drums in his band anymore.
Yeah, he fucking plays everything.
Taylor Hawkins is a pretty badass drummer.
Taylor was great. I mean, you know, he's great on the Alanis Morissette record, and then he ends
and
up...
And then Dave stole him.
Yeah, yeah. Dave's like, oh, I like those drums.
And that worked out all right.
Yeah.
Dave and Taylor are thick as thieves. They're best buds.
Yeah. Do you have any good college, when you were in college, and it was all punk music, I assume, you're playing punk music?
A lot of punk rock, yeah.
Did you ever think, well, where is this going to go? Are we just going to be punk bands? Like, what was your, what's kind of one of your favorite moments from your band in college?
Well, we, Duke and I, were in a band called Spooner, and we were sort of a new wave... slightly punky, slightly new wave, and slightly sort of Tom Petty Americana all rolled into one, if that makes any sense. And I remember we had an offer. We put out an EP in our own label, Boat Records. It was just a Madison label that we put a bunch of other Madison bands out on. And we got some attention in the Midwest, and we got a call. Clive Davis wanted to come and see us. And we're like, oh my God, Clive Davis? Holy shit. And he said he wants to see you like next weekend. And we're like, okay. We didn't have anything booked. So we scrambled around. We called up a club owner in Chicago. And we drove down that Saturday to play. And we called some friends. There was no advertising for it. And it was a really weird day because our manager, Bob, picked Clive up at O'Hare Airport. He was so nervous, he forgot to turn his handbrake off. And the car started on fire on the interstate between, this is for a real story, between O'Hare and the club. Meanwhile, at the club, you know, we just had a handful of our friends show up, and the guy, the stage manager, said, you know, I'm really sorry, but we just got a court order. This guy who lives across the street is pissed off. His CB radio plays through the PA. And we hear this, and so we had my friend Pete Love, who was sort of our tour manager for many years. He went over, and I said, just keep talking to the guy. Don't let him go upstairs and talk on the CB radio. Just talk to him for like 2 hours while we try and do a little 40-minute set for Clive. And we were scared shitless. And it was literally Clive and his A&R guy sitting right where you are sitting right now, like four feet away. And we played like 10 songs. And then, you know, there was a few of our friends clapping like this. And then we went and sat down with Clive, and he said, I really like this music quite a bit. You know, I think I want to just get you in the studio with a producer. His name is Robert, and I think let's just cut a couple tracks and see where it goes. So we were really excited. Yeah. After he left, our attorney said, you know what? You can do better than just a single deal. I think we should hold out. Let's see if we can get an album, a one or two album deal. And it fell apart. The whole deal fell apart. We started talking to Capitol and Elektra and Arista and Columbia. The deal fell apart. And we ended up having to do it ourselves on Boat Records. And that's how I learned to produce records. It turns out the producer, Robert, was Mutt Lang. Robert John Lang. That's who he wanted to put us in the studio with. Now, here's what would have happened. Either I would have absorbed everything and probably be a better producer than I am now, or he would have kicked my ass and I would have quit the music business forever.
But you'll never know.
I'll never know.
But it all worked out great.
It all worked out in the end, yeah.
But that's what's so great is it's like that's almost like a Forrest Gump moment where you're like, oh, you were right there at that weird, just that little
It was a really
moment.
Weird, super weird night. Super weird night.
And were you guys, because the legal process can kill a lot of things. Like, the legal process is like you get all excited about the creative process, and it's like, okay, here come the lawyers, and now it's just all the fun's going to get squeezed out because they have to, you know, come up with the 50 million different horrible things that could happen and who owns what. And so, you know, are you good at kind of keeping your enthusiasm for the business part while you're trying to keep the creative part going?
Yeah, you sort of ignore the business part. Every now and then you have to put that on your head, that sort of compartmentalize a little bit and just go, okay, we got to deal with this aspect of it, and then just put it aside, you know, so it doesn't get in the way of, you know, your art or making creative decisions. And sometimes I have to tell artists that too, like, don't schedule a meeting with your manager, you know, half hour before you're going to do vocals.
That's a great idea because you're going to get in your head, you're going to get cranky, you're going to feel weird.
Yeah, it's just going to bum you out.
When you
there was another band, I can't name names, but another band who I worked with, they called their manager the Vibe Crusher. and I'd go, dude, the Vibe Crusher's coming by the studio. I go, really? Does he have to come by? Oh, man. This is a long time ago. And I don't really even know if he works in the business anymore. I think he was such a Vibe Crusher that he kind of got forced out.
You don't want that to be your brand as a manager.
Now he's crushing vibes at his local Starbucks.
Yeah, so anyway. But that, yeah. Dude, the Vibe Crusher's coming by.
How do the different artists work that you've worked with between Billy Corrigan and, you know, like Dave and those guys, and like, is it does it kind of feel like, oh, they're all part of the same, cut from the same cloth, or is it really everyone is so unique that you have to figure out how to kind of navigate each situation?
Everybody's pretty unique in their own way, how they get motivated, how they go through a writing process and recording process. In some instances, it's easier. In some instances, it's kind of like pulling teeth, you know, sometimes to really draw performances out and get people to relax. It really depends. Sometimes it varies from song to song, you know, with an artist. Some songs come really easy and some come really, really hard and they're a struggle. And you never know. Again, that's why I said earlier, when you go in the studio, I think in my head, here's what we're going to do today. And then usually that doesn't always happen exactly like I think it's going to.
Have you been completely surprised by something that you thought, well, I guess we gave this the old college try, and then all of a sudden that thing becomes huge?
Yeah. I mean, some songs, you're almost ready to throw in the towel, and then you figure out something to do. Sometimes it's walking away or taking a U-turn, trying to figure out something to salvage it. Working with the Pumpkins on Siamese Dream, we deliberately kept pushing the song Disarm to the back burner because it didn't sound good. And the reason it sounded shitty was because the band was playing live. They were in the big tracking room in Atlanta, and they kept cutting it with live drums, bass, guitars, like we cut it the rest of the record. And never sounded right. And I just kept putting aside. Billy say, let's cut Disarm today. I go, nah, let's do Soma. We got to finish. You know, we kind of know where that is. And it was the last song we tracked, I think. And, you know, the band was in recording it, and it just sounded terrible. And I didn't really know what to do. And out of frustration, Billy Corgan walked out of the studio into the control room and just sat on the couch and started playing the acoustic guitar. And I just went, that's how it has to sound. And very quickly, we recorded Billy with just a mic sitting on the couch and told everybody to stay out of the control room for like half an hour. And then we just built the whole song up. And rather than do it as a rock song, we did it more orchestrally and added some little bit of piano and some percussion and strings and things. And to me, it sort of made the song 1,000 times more emotional than we were tracking it as a live band.
Wow, so you really do I mean, there's such a lesson about like being inflexible and kind of being like, no, this all has to be this thing. All the songs have to be this, of being able to take a step back and saying, hey, you know, we can experiment or we can try. Like, what do you think is the weirdest thing that you've ever tried in a session?
Putting a microphone into a bucket of sand. It did not sound very good.
Oh, that's interesting. I would have thought. Into a bucket
of sand. That was for a garbage session. We were trying to get a really strange filtered sound directly from the mic. And I don't remember why. I think some beer had been consumed that mm-hmm. night.
Sure, sure.
And like on many garbage sessions, especially the early, that first record, a lot of beer was consumed. And I don't know why. We wanted it to sound sort of distant, and we thought the sand would filter the microphone to a certain extent, but it sounded terrible.
It sounded like a microphone in sand.
And it's stuck into a bucket of sand, yeah.
Is it harder to produce your own stuff because it's you? Is it harder to separate yourself as a producer from a performer, or do you find that easier than producing other people?
I kind of find it harder in a way because with garbage, it's multi-layer. Like I can bring in a song idea. I can play drums or guitar or bass. I can help arrange. I can make production decisions. All four of us share the same role, so pretty much all the time. And we argue a lot. Sometimes, you know, I'm not quite sure where a song should go. You know, who's really, I think, is the kind of the best litmus test in the band is Shirley. I think she seems to, if we're struggling, she usually will say one or two things to me or the rest of the band will go, oh, and a light bulb will go off. One of the songs on the new record, on Strange Little Birds, is called Even Though Our Love Is Doomed. And I came up with that title, you know, riding in a car. I come up with a lot of music ideas in my car in L.A. because you're in your car a lot in L.A., you know.
Yeah.
And so I'll hold up my phone.
Do you have
no
radio on? What do you do?
I listen to the radio, and I listen to podcasts. Yeah. I'll download them on my phone and listen to them. I don't listen to that, not as much commercial radio as yeah. I do it, more like internet stuff. But So I came up with this title, and I just sort of sang the melody line to it and didn't really know what to do with it. And I emailed Shirley that, and I got home late that night, and I said, I have this song idea, Even Though Our Love Is Doomed. She goes, oh, I love the title. I love it. It's gothy and weird, and it's like Wuthering Heights and yeah. whatever. And so I was encouraged by that. And then over the course of a couple months, I tried to write some demos just to bring into the band. And I made one that was sort of electro-y, dance-y, one that was sort of punk rocky, one that sort of had more almost folky guitars. And none of them sounded very good. And then I changed the tempo, made it into more of a swing groove, almost like that kind of thing. That didn't sound good. So I just let it fall by the wayside. And Cheryl asked me a couple months later, what happened to that song, Even Though Our Love Is Doomed? I really love that title. And I said, I've made three or four demos and they all suck. And she said, just record something really simple. And all I had was the lines on the chorus, a couple of lyrics on the chorus. And so I panicked. The next day, I went down to my home studio. I picked up the bass, and I wrote this bass line, thinking I have to have at least an intro or some other chords to the song. And I wrote all the lyrics in 5 minutes. And I left it really spare, and I took it in, and Shirley listened to it and went, I love it. And she sang it once, and that's what you hear on the record.
Oh, shit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a one-er?
So I made that demo in the morning, took it in, she heard it once and sang it once, and it was kind of done after struggling for 2 months trying to figure out how to record the song, you know, what it should sound like.
So, but that's also a good lesson in, you know, maybe when you are trying to make something work, walking away and then coming back, you know, you have a different perspective by that time. You can go back and you have a different view on what it is that you were trying to do, or maybe you just needed to live for 2 months. before it made sense to you.
Yeah, sometimes you got to go home. Just go, you know what? Let's call it a day, turn the tape machines off, turn the computers off, go home, and then you wake up in the morning, have a cup of coffee, and your brain will go, oh, this makes total sense. Here's what we need to do. You know, sometimes you just got to get away from it.
Do you have days in the studio where literally nothing gets recorded?
Yeah. Yeah, you have days where you record. The guitars all sound out of tune. The feel, whether it's with garbage or working with other bands, you know, you have off days, and it's hard to take those days because everybody always expects that, you know, we'll get something great today, and it's frustrating when that happens. But you have to know when to just walk away, you know,
and
come back.
How do you decompress after those?
Have a ice cold beer.
Yeah. Oh, he's Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
All right.
Yeah, he's Wisconsin.
It checks out, Chris. He's from Wisconsin.
He's got a brew. He has a brat, and then everything's fine. Yeah. Are you working on? Do you like to work on a lot of different stuff at once, or do you need to just focus on one thing at a time?
I'm kind of a one project at a time type of person. I love Rick Rubin's work, and he's sometimes is doing like five or six records at once, and he's able to do that. I need to kind of focus on one thing and just kind of immerse myself in it, and then when it's done, I'll jump into something else. Occasionally, I'll work on other things at the same time, but I like that kind of tunnel vision in a way.
Yeah,
I think I make better records for it.
Are you good once a project is done? To be really done with it, or when you hear, like, if you listen to Nevermind now, you're like, fuck, I should've, like, or is it, are you able to?
I want to go back and tweak those things I never quite nailed. Some things, it's hard. Like Only Happy When It Rains, I never got that mix on that song. I know was a big hit for us and, you know, whatever. But on the last day, we'd finished the record, and we were flying on a Monday morning to New York from Madison to master the record. And I went in on a Sunday night and recalled the track and tried to remix it again because I didn't like the way it sounded. And I just had to throw my hands in the air and go, I guess it's done.
Yeah. What is it?
Do you still hear it? Do you still go?
Oh, yeah. It doesn't sound the mix doesn't sound right to me. The balance of the guitars and the drums and especially the end of the song, I didn't quite get how I heard it in my head, but. Gotta let it go, man.
Tom, I was watching a Damn the Torpedoes documentary about the mix, of, like that, the whole making of that record, and they, Tom and Ivy, what the producer,
Jimmy Iovine,
yeah, they kept trying to get that final mix right, and they were like, ah, oh, it doesn't sound right, and then they would fly to New York and go to a studio and try to mix it there. They'd be like, ah, it still doesn't sound right. They'd fly to a different studio. They went to four studios and they were finally like, eh, whatever.
Well, that, I love that documentary. I love Tom Petty too. He's one of my heroes.
I love Tom Petty too.
You know, there was always a lot of tension between Tom and Stan Lynch. And I think Jimmy and Tom were never quite happy with Stan Lynch's drumming. I thought he was an amazing drummer. I saw Tom play back in the day. And recently I've seen him play probably 15 or 20 times and just love him.
He's touring with Mudcrutch right now.
Yeah, I know. That's cool.
It's like crazy.
They, you know, when on Damn the Torpedoes, some of those songs they tracked 100 times.
It's crazy. It's crazy what they went through.
You know, trying to get the right feel, whatever.
I mean, it's a great album.
How do you, how do you even know at that point? It's like, you know, when you hear, like, Kubrick shot this scene 200, like, how do you even know at, like, 160 takes? Like, how do you even know what reality is anymore at that point?
In my experience, it's good to remember the first couple takes because usually there's something pretty magical with them. And what I find is when you do more takes, it spirals down for quite a while, and then it takes a long time to get back up to that, to your A game. Mm. And then it can get really good again, but it's always this path, really good, really bad, and then you just got to wait it out till you get back to where it gets really good. And so that's why the first 1, 2, 3, 4 takes, usually you should pay attention to those.
God, but hearing about going to the different studios around the country and also thinking about that time in the music business where it was like, get a jet. We'll just, it's like, you know, there was...
Damn Torpedoes was happening while the legal battle was happening, right, with the record company?
No, that was... Or it was that? After Damn the Torpedoes, but... They may have the legal battle may have started because I remember I think weren't they hiding the
tapes? Yeah, they were hiding the tapes, so the record company couldn't get them. They were hiding the master tapes for Damn the Torpedoes, and like only one guy knew where the tapes were, and he never told anyone where it was. His job at the end of the night after they left the studio to take all the tapes, put them in a station wagon, and go hide them.
Holy shit! it just seems like it feels like the 70s and the 80s were probably a really fun time. When it just seemed like this is a never ending journey that we're on, that the music business is not going to change at all. We can, you know,
They had open checkbooks back then too, you know. Just they would, oh, you need $100,000 for this, no problem. Right. You know, things have
we're
changed.
We're going to charge
quite.
This back to you, of course. But here, yeah. You'll be indebted to us for life. But you don't know, worry,
we're going to fly out that $100,000 on our own jet. Here you go, go pick it up in Van Nuys,
and we're going to charge you for the jet that we sent.
Also,
down to give
gas
you the money.
Is very expensive right now.
Yeah,
it's the '70s.
Yeah, you know, that's something you in the back of your head as an artist, you go, oh, yeah, it's recoupable. But then you don't always remember. Everything's getting billed back to you. And then you look at the royalty statement when you're done after selling a million records and there was no money. You know, and that happened to lots of artists.
Yeah. Because they just did. I mean, it just.
Well, you don't think about it.
You don't think about it. It's like, oh, this is free money. They're just giving us this to make this. Oh, this will be fine. I don't think anyone. I'm not sure anyone even really talked about it. I just remember that. Was it a Behind the Music? I don't know.
Yes, it was
the TLC
the
one. Was TLC? I think it was TLC, and I think it was. I don't remember if it was Lisa. I don't know if it was Left Eye or Chili or one of them was like. So they, you know, they tell you you're going to get $100,000 for this thing, and then what you don't realize is, you know, this much goes to taxes, this much goes to other people, this much goes to the touring expenses, this much, and then you're left with nothing. You know, by the end of it. And it's a whole, you know, like it's a great way for a lot of other people other than the artist to actually make money.
That still is true today.
Still today.
Yeah. Especially, I think, you know, some of the bigger stars, like in R&B and hip hop, a lot of times there's multiple writers, there's a whole posse and entourage. They have, you know, there's a lot of things going on. You know, a lot of younger bands now are getting smarter to that and they can take care of a lot of things on their own, especially with the internet and just they can do their own marketing. You know, a really smart band now can record an amazing track and post it, you know, on their own, and it can go viral in 24 hours and a million people can hear it. Yeah. And that 20 years ago had to go through the gatekeepers, you know, the big labels for that to happen.
Well, when you were starting in Wisconsin and you had your label, how were you getting the music out? Was it just like touring and go and just doing local shows in the region?
Yeah, we would hand stamp the 7-inch. You know, sometimes we'd get a bunch of beer, get our friends over, and we'd get 1,000 singles and we'd glue them, and then we'd take them around to the local record stores in Madison and in Kenosha and Milwaukee and La Crosse and Eau Claire, and maybe it was every now and then drive down to Chicago and drop off some, and that was it. We were the label and the distributor.
Did you like that part of it?
I did for a while. Yeah, it's fun. You know, when you're starting out, it's just to be part of everything. And, you know, it was a whole underground scene. It was very, very supportive, very community-oriented. You know, a lot of bands helped each other out. They would, you know, you'd crash in people's couches and, you know, couldn't afford to stay in hotels. Or every now and then you'd get one room for the band and crew and everybody would just so they had a shower, you know. But you don't really care about when you're young like that and making music. You don't really think that when I grow up, is this what I'm going to do? You know, you're just in the moment kind of doing it and it's fun.
Did you have any kind of existential crisis because, you know, you're starting in punk bands and you're producing a lot of underground stuff, and then all of a sudden, you know, Siamese Dream does well, and Nevermind does well, and all of a sudden, you realize, like, oh, wait, now I am kind of a part of the machine, but I was rebellious before. Was there ever any kind of crisis of conscience with that, or were you able to go, oh, no, but this is what I wanted? You know, I did that other stuff before, because no one just handed me a giant record deal in Wisconsin.
Well, after the success of Nevermind, I got bombarded with managers and publishers and labels who thought I had some magic button I could push and turn them into a famous grunge band. And it was quite ludicrous because I would get folk singers or blues players, and they just thought I could change them sonically and they would fit right in the current alternative movement. And I got offers to set up a studio in London and move to New York or LA and you know, sign with big management companies. And I said no to all that. I decided I wanted to stay in Madison because I felt like it would keep me grounded and sort of not, I wouldn't really get caught up in whatever current trends were going on. And plus I just liked it because we were so far. It was not easy to get to Madison. It was always two flights. You had to fly to Chicago and then jump in another, a smaller plane to Madison. So usually the Vibe Crushers didn't come to Madison, you know? We were kind of left to our own devices, and that was a good thing.
Was there a particular track on Nevermind that you thought that you really thought was gonna, like, did it all play out exactly the way that you thought it would?
Did you ever have your George Martin moment where you took off your headphones and were like, boys, you got your first number one?
I always assume that's what happens, like, with a hit record, that they all just kind of sit back and crack their knuckles and go, we did it!
I wish I had the wherewithal to understand that at the time, you know, it's, God bless George Martin. No, I had no idea. I knew Teen Spirit was a phenomenal song. It was the first song that the band played in rehearsals. When I went to North, we had a couple days of rehearsal in North Hollywood before we went into Sound City. And that's when I first met Dave Grohl. And they played Teen Spirit, and it sounded phenomenal. It just blew my doors off. I remember pacing around the room going, oh my God, this sounds incredible. Mm-hmm. And I looked at Dave's, I was watching Dave drum, because that's the first thing you got to worry about, is the drummer good? Because that's the first thing you got to make sure you nail when you're tracking something. And it was so loud, and I realized he didn't have any mics on the drums. That Chris had this giant bass rig, and Kurt had a Mesa Boogie that was just ear-shattering loud, and yet the drums were as loud as the guitar and the bass in the room. And Dave was so solid. And I just remember kind of sweating, and at the end I said, play it again. And then I started taking some notes. I had minimal work to do on the song. It was we did a little bit of arranging on it. But
he's such a powerful drummer. Dave is,
and the band
so
was
hard.
Tight. You know, they spent 6 months pretty much rehearsing every day before we went in to cut Nevermind. So they were tight, and they were focused. You know, contrary to whatever everybody thinks, they were slackers. That was not true. They wanted to make a really good, really focused record.
That's so fascinating that it's that even that part of the that aesthetic part of the culture, that aesthetic part of grunge. Because it always seems like, fortunately or unfortunately, the aesthetic quality kind of leads that's the thing that's in front, and then people, oh, the music too, you know. It's like, you know, with hair metal, it was all the hair and the thing. With grunge, it was, you know, people were seeing all the flannel, and that became the thing.
And they're really just, like, skins. They're just filters or costumes or whatever. It doesn't even really, it's all kind of the same thing from a certain point of view.
At least in grunge, it made sense, because all those clothes were comfortable.
They were comfortable.
You know, I look in my wardrobe. I've got a couple flannel shirts still. I haven't worn them for a while. But
you have a couple gas station shirts that say, like, Clyde or whatever.
I think I did. Yeah, Fred. I had one that said, a gray one that said Fred on it.
You got your Doc Martens in there somewhere.
I'll tell you, though, for us and my friends, it was because there was a St. Vinny DePaul's, like, two blocks from Smart Studios. And you could get a couple of shirts for a dollar. It just, so no one cared about... Yeah. Buying nice clothes because nobody could afford them, you know. So,
and then within a couple of years, then they were the most expensive clothes in the store. Were like the second hand.
Yeah, then designer grunge. Yeah, you go to Barney's, you could get a flannel shirt for like $400.
Do you ever find yourself like in a Barney's and you see like $300 for a Nirvana shirt? Are you fucking kidding me? Like, do you ever speak up? Do you ever want to speak up and go, come on, guys, let's?
No. You know, I remember Billy Corgan used to make fun of me because I would wear either T-shirts or flannel shirts, and I started dressing it up with a black vest.
Ah, nice.
And that's because I wanted to set myself up. Okay, I'm the producer. I'm in charge here, you guys. I'm going to class it up a little bit. I'm going to put on a vest today, and Billy still makes fun of me.
You need something with buttons.
Yeah, I know, but Billy... And I'm a huge Smashing Pumpkins fan. Like, still regularly listen to Pumpkins stuff, but... With Melancholy, I remember seeing him at the Video Music Awards that year. It was like, when did the Uncle Festering happen? Like, his head was shaved, and he was in this, like, gothic, one-piece, like, fester-like robe. I mean, that was... If anyone ever gives you shit about wearing a vest, you can be like, yeah, but what about this period in your wardrobe?
You know, I think he, like a lot of people, just was sort of looking at where music was going and realizing alternative styles or whatever were becoming passe. And I think he just wanted to, you know, it's show business. He just wanted to do something different.
Do you think once they give up, do you think once they put a, once they give it a label, not a record label, but like once they give the movement a label, then it's kind of downhill from there? Like once they called it alternative, it's like, okay, this isn't really alternative anymore because they're all hit songs.
Yeah, sometimes I think that happens. You know, a lot of people think I'm from Seattle. Because, and they would say, oh, you're a grunge producer. And I mean, I've done a lot of other music besides Nirvana and the Pumpkins, and I did a lot of punk rock and grungy sounding records, but I've done a lot of other things like that. So I found it annoying at the time, especially when the first Garbage record came out, because we made a record that sounded quite different than everything that was on alternative radio. And we would do some of the first interviews, and I could see the journalists sort of listening to Shirley and Duke and Steve and me answer our questions about Garbage. And then they would finally go, okay, what was it like working with Kurt Cobain?
Right.
What was it like working with Billy Corgan? And I, at that time, I just said, I don't really want to talk about that. You know, I'm not trying to be a dickhead about it, but I'm really kind of here to talk about Garbage. And now everybody just wants to talk to Shirley. Hey, you butch, is Shirley around? And that's how it should be, you know?
Yeah, there's always I feel like there's a – when you work with people that sort of become – because I've worked with people before too that become like the face of something, and then it's always like, hey, what was that like? Did you sleep with that person? What's that? What do they do? And you're like, I don't know.
What's that? What do they do?
I mean, seriously.
But
I really – it was Cameron Crowe, I think, that really kind of – when that single soundtrack is still completely holds up. That was really kind of the – that was sort of like, I feel like, the kind of the major flag stick in the ground of this is a cultural movement that's happening. You know, that – that movie still holds up, by the way.
Speaking of Cameron Crowe, he's got a new show that I taped. I haven't seen it yet. Roadies, which looks –
oh yeah, Roadies is coming. Yeah,
and
yeah.
It looks quite – I saw the trailer. It looks quite funny. It looks cool.
Yeah. Do you – what kind of stuff do you like to watch? What do you watch? Comedy or sci-fi?
God, I hardly get a chance to even watch much TV these days. I watch a bunch of stuff that's HBO and Showtime. I think the programming's been really good. Netflix is great. Lately, I've just been burning through music documentaries.
Right.
And, I sort of can't seem to get enough of them. You know, talking about
they
Tom Petty.
More. The Jaco Pastorium. Did you watch that one?
I haven't seen it. And I've had a couple of people write me and say it's fantastic. So I'm going to check that out. It's on Netflix, right?
Yeah.
What's your favorite one?
Oh, man. You know, I love that Tom Petty, that 4-hour Tom Petty documentary.
I've
watched it. I've watched it like four times. I watched it like four times.
It's called Running Down a Dream.
Yeah, Running Down a Dream. It's two-hour parts. You know what I also liked, and a lot of people kind of would diss me for this, but I like that Eagles documentary that came out.
Oh, yeah.
Especially the first half where it's all this footage of them like playing with Linda Ronstadt and their Glenn Frey's living in this apartment upstairs, and here's Jackson Brown working on the same song, Doctor My Eyes, like hundreds of times trying to figure out the second verse. And Glenn Frey's going, that's how you write songs. You just keep working at it over and over and over and over again. It's a pretty cool documentary.
Holy shit. I didn't see that one. Did you see that?
Yeah. It was on HBO, came out, 2 years ago, right? The Eagles one? Yeah, but that, I do highly recommend the Tom Petty one.
You know, I have been working with a director on a Smart Studios documentary. It's a Smart Studios story that's done. We're just trying to get all the music and licensing cleared. And I did, when he started the film a couple years ago, and she's been working on collecting archival stuff for like 5 or 6 years, right around when Smart closed its doors. But it was great to go back, and that's when I started getting into all these documentaries, because we were sort of trying to figure out the content and what kind of story you want to tell, what the narrative is going to be, and Wendy's done a great job with it. But that's when I really started immersing myself into a documentary, especially on Netflix, because they have a lot of great documentaries.
Are you watching to learn, or are you just watching to relate?
A little bit to relate, but a lot of it is as a fan. You know, I kind of feel like every time I watch it, I find out something new about a band. I just watched, what's it called? The West End. It's a British band. And I didn't know anything about. I'm totally brain dead right now. They were a new romantic band. It's called like the West End Boys. And it's not about.
Not about the Pet Shop Boys?
Not about the Pet Shop Boys. Who is it? Oh, it'll come to me here. But it's fantastic, and I didn't know of the Western world. Blah, blah, blah.
Katie, Google.
British band, something of the Western world. Google that shit. Western. Damn it, my brain. Come on, brain.
Western world. Western.
They're a new romantic.
Soul Boys?
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. Soul Boys, the Western world. And who is it about? Spandau.
Well, that's not Spandau. Spandau Ballet.
Spandau Ballet. And I only knew a couple of their hits.
True and Gold.
And fantastic songs. And the documentary is amazing. And I highly recommend it, even if you don't know anything about the band. It's just a really fascinating story. Like a lot of good documentaries, they usually take you on a on a journey that sometimes goes into some dark places and very unexpected places. But they're really interesting to watch.
Is there one about the Tubes? I'm kind of fascinated with the Tubes.
There should be, if there's not. If there is, I haven't seen that
one,
Chris.
Weren't they almost kind of like a Parliament-style band where it was just like a fucking free-for-all? Like anything could happen at one of their shows, and they had like these massive ensembles of people, and they were just these crazy costume fuck-arounds.
Thinking of the Flaming Lips.
Definitely thinking of the Tubes.
Yeah, and they were badass players. You know, I remember like some of those early singles they had too. That the production and just the chops, the play and the dexterity of the musicians was at a very, very high level.
Are you pretty open to all types of music, or are you snobby about? Or are you like, oh, but I won't listen to country. Like, are you pretty much just all music?
You know, I listen to so many different kinds of music, and I think I have to thank my mom for that. She was a music teacher, and growing up in Viroqua, on the radio, you heard country music and polka music.
Yes!
And my mom played Nat King Cole and the Tijuana Brass, and she bought Beatles records and Stones records and musicals. God, I've heard so many musicals. Every night at dinner, she'd put on like Camelot or West Side Story or something. And she played piano and trumpet, so I was always sort of inundated with music. And she would hear some song and a melody and just go, that melody is lovely. And I would think, it is lovely. And it could be some pop throwaway pop song or whatever. You know, she just appreciated it for what it could be. And I feel the same way. I listen to all different kinds of music.
Please tell me that you've ever seen an episode of the Big Joe Polka Show.
I have not.
What?
I'm gonna have to, from your region
of the country.
I'm going to have to check it out.
I don't know if it's still around. Katie, see if Big Joe Polka's... I caught it years ago. There was a channel called RFD. It was like the Rural Farming District channel. So it was like during the day there were a lot of like tractor auctions on this channel.
Sure.
And cattle auctions. Yeah. And they showed... Is Big Joe Polka on there?
Well...
Oh,
bummer.
The host would be Big Joe. Yeah. Big Joe died?
Well.
God damn it.
In fairness, he was pretty big.
And he was very old. He was an older guy, too.
Yeah, I played in a polka band in college that was a cash gig, man. $200 every time I played. It was just me and a bass player, Tom Lavarda, and Cliff Benz and the Polketeers. And he would call me for pickup for weddings or whatever, parties and stuff. And we wore these red, one-size-fits-all red, big frilly shirts with, like, big collars and, droopy sleeves.
Great for drumming.
I would just set out my kick, snare, a hi-hat. I had a little cowbell. And then on the floor tom, I could put my beer. I knew some of the polkas, but there was a lot I didn't know. And Tom, like, seemed to know all of them. And Cliff would go, and here's our theme song, Musica, Musica. And every song, he would just nod at me. Was the end, like, we ended every single song that way. So I could just check out the girls dancing. I could play with one hand like this, take a sip of beer. And I got paid $200. I loved it. It was cash, never reported it. You know, just like
it's beers. It's such an interesting part of the culture, too, that polka culture. And if you're able to catch any of the – someone should do a documentary on that guy. But if you're ever able to catch any of the – they're on YouTube – but he did this show, and they would go to just these kind of like weird – it looked like they were at like a moose lodge in a lot of them, or just a weird kind of conference room that they converted. And it's a lot of older people dressed as polka as fuck. And yeah. But the best part about it is –
oh, check that out. That's fantastic.
Everything from the waist up, like expressionless, like dead-eyed expressionless. And then their feet – yeah. Katie, turn the
– yeah, they are rocking. They are really rocking. That's one rowdy crowd, Chris.
That's about as rowdy as it gets, though, but that's the best part. I mean, yeah, that's it. See, look at it. A lot of movement, no expression. A lot of movement, dead. Look, these guys, they're not even mentally present. They're just all dressed the same. It's such a fascinating part of the culture.
Yeah, I've never noticed that before, but you're right. They don't seem to be having a good time.
It doesn't look like anyone's having a good time, but their feet say they are. The disparity between the two regions of the body is fascinating to me.
Cliff had one song. He goes, we got to modernize our sound a little bit. So we worked up a polka of 2001 Space Odyssey. And I remember it just didn't seem to work musically on the accordion. And yet, sometimes
you got to go back.
Sometimes the crowds would kind of go a little nutty for that one because I think they were used to hearing songs like Musica Musica or all these classic polka numbers, and we would play Space Odyssey or 2001, and they would go, whoa, this is pretty cutting edge.
That's fantastic. Now, see, I think you need to go back to your polka roots. I think you need to go back. Who are just a couple of bands that you produced over the years that you really, maybe they didn't hit it as big, but you always think like, oh, but that was a really great band, or they're really special?
Oh, I love Freddie Johnston. I produced, I've known him for a long time. I actually have a side band with him, the Not All Boyfriends. We play covers every now and then.
Did you produce Bad Reputation?
I did, yes.
I fucking love that song.
Yeah, the record is This Perfect World.
Yes.
All the songwriting is just so brilliant. It's like every song is like a little Cormac McCarthy novel. Just you can sort of see the landscape.
Who's still alive, by the way. Yes. He did not die.
Incorrect report from USA Today.
And also another band who I'm very close with, Against Me. I did two records with Against Me, and I, you know, when I made their first record, the first record I made with them, New Wave, I thought they're like the Clash, they're going to set the world on fire, and they never really took off at alternative radio. They have a huge following. I mean, when you see them play shows, the crowd, their fans sing every song at the top of their lungs, and I love them. I love Laura Jane Grace and the band. They're incredible.
What is it, how many elements need to come together for a hit? Because it's obviously the music has to be good, or it has to have some sort of sticky element to it. But it feels like, oh, there's so many other things. There's timing, and there's if it catches the right promotion or if it gets to the right person. I mean, like, is there a consistent thing that you've seen? Like, oh, they had, you know, five of the six things you need for this to work.
God, if I had a formula like that, I could figure that out, I would love that.
Well, even if you could, it still doesn't mean you can control it. Like, you can't, it's like if you're making, you know, internet content, you can't control the viral quality of something. You just never know that part of it. But there must be other factors.
I mean, for me personally, it's still the human connection with what the human voice sounds like. If the singing and the lyrics are right, you know, the beat has got to be one thing, of course, and a great guitar riff or whatever it is, other hooks in the song. But to me, the thing that really makes a great song is that the human element of the vocalist and the lyrics and the singing.
And if you could strip all the, you know, do you ever strip all the music part away and just sort of focus in on that and go, okay, if this works, then we can figure out the other instrumentation?
Yeah, I mean, a good song, in theory, you can change the arrangement. It doesn't need to have whatever arrangement you come up with. If the song is good, you can probably change it and the song is still going to be good. But the opposite is not the same. If a song is a turd, you can polish it and polish it, and it's still going to be a turd. It's just not going to be a great song.
Because you've remixed a lot of stuff, too.
I have, yeah.
Do you like that process of taking a finished thing and being like, well, what else can we do with this?
You know, that's how Garbage started, really. Duke and Steve and I started doing remixes for House of Pain and U2 and Depeche Mode and Nine Inch Nails and whatever. And it was fun. It set the template for Garbage because we would get a tape in, like usually a 24-track tape, and we would erase everything except for the lead vocal and then record all new instrumentation. And sometimes take the vocals and change the timing or the pitch or run it through samplers and... And it was fun, and I never got asked to do club mixes. I was just making remixes and sort of doing whatever I wanted, and people seemed to like them.
Yeah.
So we kept getting offers to do them, and that was the template for Garbage. At one point, Duke and Steve and I were like, this is fun. We should maybe sort of use this idea to start a band.
Yeah, because at that time, that CD singles were pretty big, or and you would get, you know, oh, you'd buy this track, and here's five mixes.
Five remixes, yeah. For a while, it was cool, and then it became a little annoying because every time you put up, like in Garbage, we put a single out, and they'd say, well, we need like four remixes. And again, they're recoupable.
Right.
Right.
You know, unless we do it, and usually we at that point we didn't have time because we were on tour, but it and then we also found it kind of annoying because at least over in the UK and sometimes over in Europe, they would put the single out and then put like three different formats out. And they counted them all as one sale. So if you wanted to get the garbage single with all six remixes, you had to buy three CDs. Maybe they were only 99p, but they had to buy all three. But then that counted for three units sold.
Oh, gotcha.
So that was like how they wanted to get the chart positions higher.
Got it.
Mm.
Got it.
Anyway,
oh, very sneaky.
Yeah, luckily that doesn't really happen that much anymore.
No, well,
no, we're not just a lot of CDs being sold.
we're just a single culture now. Like it's just singles culture. What did you remix for you too?
I did Crash Car from what was the name of the record? Had the single Lemon on it.
Oh, that was Pop Mart.
Pop Mart.
Not Pop Mart. No, but
wasn't
was
it
before that?
Oh, I'm thinking of the Giant Lemon.
Was it Zuropa?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And a Crash Car and a Dirty Day.
Nice.
And it was cool. We took I brought in a violin player, put some strings on one of the tracks, and another one we just sort of put all this really trashy percussion and stuff on, and sometimes they work. Sometimes, you know, a lot of people don't like remixes because you're messing with a lot of fans don't always like remixes because you're messing with the original.
Yeah.
And to me, if a song, like I said, if a song is good, you can strip it down, and hopefully, it's still going to be able to interpret it in a new way.
Like, are you working with, you know, for instance, Bono in that case, or is the label just go, here you go? Do you not even deal with the original? Do you not even deal with the band?
Sometimes they just send us the 24 tracks and say, do your thing. And sometimes we would get a call and that we would talk to the band. Occasionally they would come in the studio or their manager, someone from the label would come in, but usually it would just kind of leave us alone and they might give us a little direction, but usually they're just looking for something different.
Yeah. I was, did we talk about the Morrissey thing on the podcast yet? Which Morrissey? The Morrissey thing about when he was on The Tonight Show?
Which Morrissey thing? Yes, I believe we did. Carson, we were talking about how Carson was bombing. Yes, with Dana Carvey.
Oh, with Dana, that's right. I was just so... I still cannot get over the fact that he was selling out arenas and could not get airplay back in those days. Like, what do you think is such a... What?
I mean, yeah, no, I mean, that kind of happens sometimes. It's crazy.
But now you have like radio play isn't even really is it even still a factor?
A little bit. I think radio play really factors more into like pop stars and big R&B artists and some of the bigger hip hop acts. You know, a lot of the like Katy Perry and Rihanna, they still rely on top 40 radio and their labels, the gatekeepers will. You know, they sort of follow that old model. You got to be in every magazine you can. You get as much publicity as you can. We got to be in radio. We got to do TV appearances. And ultimately, that still does seep into the culture. Now, whether it helps sell more records is dubious. You know, they probably sell some records, but not nearly what they used to sell for what they spend on it.
And Garbage, how was your tour last year?
It was great. We did, it was our 20th anniversary
right. For
the debut record. And we played the entire record, all the songs, which we did when it came out 20 years ago, but we also worked up all the B-sides.
Oh, and, cool.
Some of them were pretty weird B-sides, and we'd never played them before. And so that it took us a couple weeks of rehearsal to try and figure out how to do it, but it was really fun. We decided we were only going to do like 30 shows. We didn't want to do that, just keep running that into the ground.
There's a few garbage tracks on Rocksmith, which is the video game where you actually plug in your guitar.
Oh, you play. Yeah.
And actually play. I think they're great. They're great fun. They're fun to play. They got some good, there's really good hooks. And some heavy stretches. How big are the fucking hands? Like, because I got like a 7-fret reach, and I'm like, this hurts.
It's all magic in the studio.
I'm like, how the fuck are you actually playing this?
Do you think you guys are going to tour again anytime soon?
Yeah, we're you know, Strange Little Birds just came out and has gotten really been really well critically received, and we're doing shows through the year into the fall, and we're already talking about doing another record. I probably won't record it till sometime later next year, but we're you know, I think as a band we're still enjoying each other's company, and that's what allows us to keep going, really.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine at a certain point, no matter how much money or no matter how much of anything, you really do spend a lot of time with other people, and you probably should enjoy it. It should probably be fun.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know a lot of bands who don't even speak to each other, and yet they have had successful careers. Such crazy. Speaking of music documentaries, did you see the one on the Ramones? It's fantastic. Johnny stole Joey's girlfriend, and they didn't speak for like 20 years. Didn't say one word to each other. And yet they kept touring and putting records out. And
wow.
You know, Joey wrote the song, The KKK Took My Baby Away. That was written about Johnny.
That's awesome.
But I guess you could just stand next to someone and play, I suppose, and then just like walk off opposite sides of the stage.
Yeah, a lot of bands do that. It's a job, I guess, to a certain extent.
Well, that's what the Mamas and the Papas, I saw her again last night, was written about Denny sleeping with Michelle. So John wrote that song so they'd have to sing it on stage, which is about Denny sleeping with Michelle.
See, that's great. That's the kind of stuff I like getting out of documentaries when you hear those stories.
I still think I wish it had been longer, but the Fleetwood Mac Behind the Music is fucking amazing. Like that should be a scripted movie, just all the craziness that was happening in that band at the time.
Well, you also get out of the Tom Petty documentaries that Stevie Nicks really wanted to leave Fleetwood Mac and go to Tom Petty and be in the Heartbreakers.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Stevie came into the studio when we were doing the Sound City film.
Which is another great documentary.
And she is badass. She is so cool. She's just funny and disarming and just sits down and there's no bullshit. And yet she's Stevie Nicks. And then she went in to sing and her voice just sounds amazing. Mm. And that was a special session. It's really cool.
Do you have like one or two like things like that, like the Stevie Nicks session where you go, I can't believe I'm doing this right now?
Well, the same Sound City, Paul McCartney came in to the Foo Studio 606 and his handlers or his assistants made sure everything was set up, and we didn't know what was going to happen. They were just going to jam and write a song together. So we had the piano ready, the organ ready. There were a couple of guitar rigs, bass drums, percussion. Everything was ready. And Paul came in and just sat down in the control room and started chatting, and we just hung out for like 3 hours, and we kept asking him stories. When you were in Africa, what was it like making Band on the Run? And he's just lovely. He's so cool, man. And it was totally disarming. And then I think I finally went, why don't we think about trying to record here? And they go, oh, yes, let's go try to record. And Paul said, what's this? And he picked up this little matchbox guitar that was sitting in the corner. We're like, oh, my God, he's picking up the one thing and we're not set up to record. Anyway, and he just went in and plugged it into an amp and started doing this jamming. And Chris picked up the bass, started playing, and Dave jumped on the drums. And I sat up behind the Neve console and he said, Butch, is my mic working? And I remember looking out in the studio and went, holy fucking shit, it's Paul McCartney. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't be swearing.
No, you can swear.
No, you can't.
Swear.
And in my head, I'm going, yeah, your mic's working. And in my head going, holy shit, it's Paul McCartney. Holy shit, it's Paul McCartney. And then he started singing. I was just going, like, the hair in the back of my neck came up. And I was like, holy shit, it's Paul McCartney. And I was
I forgot to record that, Paul.
I was just trying to keep it together. But he was fantastic. Really, really awesome. Awesome to meet him.
Is there anything you want to promote before we let you go? Is there anything you want?
Oh, there's a new Garbage record.
Besides the Garbage record, is there anything else you want to talk about?
No, I mean we'll be touring Strange Little Birds this year, and I think I mentioned Wendy Schneider has done a documentary, The Smart Studio Story, on Steve and my studio back in the Midwest, and that's coming out in the fall. We got to get all the licensing for the music cleared, and she's done a really good job with the film. If you're a fan of, '90s alternative music and how the underground sort of came into the mainstream, I think you'll enjoy it.
Oh, listen, I still listen to Lithium all the time.
It's a great station.
It's like a Lithium, yeah, it's fucking great. Listen to the Sirius XM.
They throw me a curveball when they're playing Dave Matthews. I go, really, Lithium? This is weird that you would.
But Under the Table and Dreaming did enter in.
It did, yeah.
It did veer into that a little bit. Did you ever work with Dave Matthews? He's a big Dave Matthews.
No, I do. I love Dave Matthews.
I have met him a couple times. I was going to work with him on a film, and he wrote some brilliant songs for it. And then it went one of those things where it got flipped from CA to another agency, William Morris, and then it went into Turnaround and whatever. A lot of great actors were attached to it, and it was sort of ready to go, and then got put on, like a lot of movies, got put on hold.
Who was attached to it? Do you remember?
I probably shouldn't even say. I don't want to get into any trouble. I don't know the legal ramifications, but I had never met Dave before, and I was doing something with Garbage, and one of the producers and director flew me back to L.A. to go see him at the Hollywood Bowl.
Oh, I was at that show.
And like I had never seen him before, and so I go in the Hollywood Bowl, and I'm looking around going, wow, there's like 7,000 gorgeous hippie chicks here all dancing. And it was totally true.
He's like their Pied Piper.
They were going, hey, man, you want some wine? I'm like, sure. And it was a really good show, even though I didn't know, I only knew a handful of the songs. I went backstage to meet him, and he was really lovely. I'm talking to him like I'm just talking to you here, Chris, and I saw out of the corner of my eye this, something that I go, wow, there's a woman here, and there's something quite remarkable. And he goes, hey, Butch, this is Julie. And I turn, and it was Julia Roberts about this far away. She goes, hi, Butch. I love Garbage. It's really nice to meet you. And I'm like, holy shit, it's Julia Roberts. had another one of those moments.
And then finally, in conclusion, did you ever meet up with Clive Davis again and say, do you remember when you came to Madison that time?
I never have. I've been to a couple of Clive's pre-Grammy party things, but I never, there's just a lot of musicians and people in the room. I never got a chance to talk to him again. But if I do, I will definitely tell him that story. I'm sure he won't remember. Maybe he will, though.
No, he'll remember
getting
fire.
Pulled over on the car because the car started on fire and he had to get out and stand on Interstate 90 while while they got another car to pick
that.
Him up.
I almost died and it was for nothing.
Clive Davis, if you're listening, it's not too late.
Yeah, and hey, I could have worked with Mutt Lang. Oh, well.
Yeah. I guess everything else worked out okay. Everything seems fine. You're such a nice, lovely guy. Really, honestly, thank you so much. And if you guys play in Los Angeles again, I think you played the Greek last year, right?
Yes, yep.
I was out of town performing, and I couldn't go, and I really wanted to go. So if you play Los Angeles again,
we'll get you hooked up. I think we're playing in the fall. I don't know the exact dates yet, but we're probably going to play somewhere here, like in October or November.
Fantastic. Thank you, Butch Vig.
Thank you, gentlemen. It was
fun.
Enjoy
your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.